Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with a longtime friend, Dr. Jeffrey Singer. Dr. Singer is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and works in the Department of Health Policy Studies. He's a nationally recognized thought leader in health policy, particularly the harmful effects of drug prohibition. He has written extensively about the importance of harm reduction and follows national and state policy quite closely. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Singer.
Great to see you again, Jay.
Dr. Singer, before we delve into some of the specific legislation and issues at hand, I want to maybe talk generally. Could you provide a broad overview of some of the national and state level news, particularly some of the things that's going on in terms of harm reduction, drug policy? Because there's been a lot going on, and not all of it has received equal media coverage.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on, some good, some bad, some contradictory. So on the harm reduction for opioids front, the good news is that, as you may be well aware, on the state level drug paraphernalia laws really stand in the way of harm reduction organizations wanting to help people. Because, for example, it's up until recently in most states, if you did so much as hand out fentanyl test strips to people to test to see if what they purchased on the black market's got fentanyl in it or whatever, or if it is fentanyl and they thought it was not, well, you can get arrested for handing out drug paraphernalia because that's equipment used to test drugs. But now many states, state legislatures have passed laws exempting fentanyl test strips from the drug paraphernalia laws. Now, the good news about that is now you don't have to worry about getting arrested if you hand out fentanyl test strips. But as I've discussed many times before, the iron law of prohibition, which is the harder the law enforcement, the harder the drugs. So it incentivizes the continued development of new, more potent forms of drugs, which are easier to smuggle because they're smaller in sizes and you could sell it into more units. So already we're seeing, for the last couple of years now, it's widely known, we're seeing this veterinary tranquilizer xylazine getting mixed in with the fentanyl. Users call it tranq, and it's the bad news is it's not reversible by the overdose naloxone because it's not an opioid, but it greatly potentiates the effect of the opioid, and a lot of people now are dying from overdoses that are a combination of fentanyl and xylazine. In fact, the DEA reported in the spring that something like 40% of all fentanyl they're seizing has xylazine in it. So,
wow.
The same company that makes fentanyl test strips makes xylazine test strips. But if you're in a state like my state of Arizona, they amended the drug paraphernalia law to permit fentanyl test strips. So now you got to go back to the legislature and say, how about xylazine test strips? Oh, okay, well, let's debate that. And so many lawmakers, and I would take this position, I think you should get rid of all the paraphernalia laws because they're in the way of handing out clean syringes, et cetera. But if you're not going to do that, at least just get rid of the paraphernalia, part of paraphernalia law that says testing equipment or equipment used to test illicit drugs is illegal as drug paraphernalia. Just get rid of that because there's always going to be the next thing coming down the pike, and you want to have to keep going back to the legislature to get them to okay that exception to the paraphernalia law. So that's what's going on. And in some states, more and more states are at least amending that. Texas lawmakers, the governor of Texas, who had been against allowing fentanyl test strips to be distributed, recently changed his position on that and said he's in favor of it. But unfortunately, the Texas legislature didn't pass it and send it to his desk. As you probably know, and in my opinion, it's bizarre, but a lot of people think, I don't want to give out fentanyl test strips because I'm just enabling drug use. So I guess they'd rather see people die. And to me, that's the same mentality. If you want to be consistent, then we as doctors, I think you can make use that same argument to say we shouldn't treat people who develop COPD from smoking because aren't we just enabling their smoking habit? Maybe we should just let them die untreated. So, I mean, it's the same kind of mentality. So that's what's happening on a state level. on a national level, the current head of the ONDCP, the drug czar, Dr. Rahul Gupta, he's very positive on harm reduction.
He is
very pro harm reduction. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. He's been advocating reforms to allow, for example, syringe services programs and fentanyl test strips. But also, there's a bill that was introduced in Congress. It has bipartisan sponsors in both houses. In the Senate, it's the two co-sponsors are Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Rand Paul of Kentucky. It's also joined by Mike Braun of Indiana. And in the House, it's Donald Norcross of New Jersey and Don Bacon of Nebraska, and there are the co-sponsors. Bacon is a Republican. Of course, Rand Paul is a Republican. Markey's a Democrat. And this bill would change the methadone laws. Many people don't know this. I had a paper come out on this in September. Prior to 1972, in this country, if you were a physician and you wanted to treat somebody for substance use, opioid use disorder, you could prescribe methadone for them and follow them in your office or clinic in an ambulatory way, just like you would follow your patients with diabetes or high blood pressure or anything like that. But we all know now methadone is a proven, one of the most effective treatments for addiction to opioids. So starting after the Controlled Substance Act was passed in 1972, treatment with methadone and the treatment of opioid addiction was treated differently. And people with addiction were kind of segregated from the rest of the population, stigmatized, almost treated like people who have leprosy.
Yeah.
And so instead of being able to go to your doctor's office, you have to go to these government-approved, DEA-approved clinics, which are few and far between. They're so heavily regulated, there aren't a lot of them that are around. And then you got to take it, the methadone, every day in the presence of clinic staff because you can't be trusted. You're an addict. And you have to come every day to get your methadone. You can't be prescribed any to take home until a certain period of time. And then communities fight the opening up of these clinics in their neighborhoods because they don't want to, quote unquote, attract drug addicts. So meanwhile, in England, the UK, and Canada, since the beginning, since we discovered methadone works, primary care clinicians have been treating people for opioid use disorder with methadone. There's a bill in Congress now that would allow board-certified addiction specialists to treat patients in their office as opposed to them having to go to those methadone treatment centers. There aren't nearly enough addiction specialists in this country for that to make a big difference, but it's a step in the right direction. And they're getting resistance, as you might expect, from the people who own and operate the methadone clinics, because it's almost like they're reacting the way the taxi cartels reacted when Uber and Lyft showed up. They're basically, politically, they're limiting the bill to addiction medicine specialists because that kind of takes a part of the argument away from the opposing opioid treatment program clinics, because they're saying, no, this is complicated. You can't just let anybody treat addiction.
Yeah.
Us. So they're saying, so you're telling me a board certified addiction specialist is not qualified? So that's a step in the right direction, but I would like to see it go even further and where primary care doctors can treat it. So
that's interesting.
Level.
So it's very interesting how it's parried in such a way, because it's almost like the clinical certifications almost become a form of competitive advantage, at least in the eyes of lawmakers, in determining level of access to certain forms of treatment. I want to talk a little bit of what you mentioned earlier about cognitive dissonance in drug paraphernalia laws. There is this notion, as you alluded to, in comparing addiction treatment with COPD or other chronic conditions, in which the belief is that by educating or empowering patients to make safe decisions, you are enabling harmful behavior to society. And we see that particularly for drug addiction, but not so much with other conditions that have less of a stigma. From your vantage point as a national policy leader, as somebody who sees the inner workings of how policy works, how do you reconcile the cognitive dissonance? Do you see it in real time?
Yeah, I see it in real time. I think it's a combination of moralizing. Well, a lot of it has to do with moralizing. And also, we selectively decide which kind of behaviors we accept. So, for example, you know, when we have patients who they make the wrong lifestyle decisions regarding how they eat and whether or not they get enough exercise, and they get themselves into a situation where they got borderline diabetes and, you know, high cholesterol and high blood pressure, and we think in many cases we probably could get, we wouldn't have to put them on medication if we could just get them to make changes in the way they're eating and in their habits and their exercise habits. But for whatever reason, either they can't or they don't want to, or they're willing to take the risk because they enjoy whatever they're engaging in, they don't. So what do? So when we prescribe a blood pressure medicine for them and a statin drug for their cholesterol and maybe metformin for their, you know, their changing A1C, this is harm reduction. We're not necessarily endorsing their choice. In fact, we're advising them against it. But as physicians, our mission is to heal the sick and try to ease suffering, right? So we're doing our job. We say, okay, well, if you're not going to do what I think you should do, at least let me recommend some things you could do to make what you're doing less dangerous to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so why is it that we don't see a problem with that? Or smoking, which is very harmful. But when a person develops, you know, COPD from smoking and they need oxygen and they need bronchodilators, we have no problems prescribing that for them. And they, even if they continue smoking, and we continue to tell them to stop smoking, but we're humane enough to say, well, okay, well, let me get you some oxygen so you're not starving for oxygen and giving yourself a heart attack earlier than you otherwise will get one. So, or alcohol, when people develop complications of alcohol use. But for some reason, certain categories of drugs we have arbitrarily decided are bad. And there are some people whose attitude is that I'd rather see you die from doing that to set an example to others than to help you. And I it contradicts all the attitudes of the other things. It's very arbitrary, very moralizing, makes no rational sense, and it's actually cruel, inhumane.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't the Ode to Maimonides, which is something medical students recite almost on an annual basis, there's a line, "May I never see in a patient nothing but a creature in pain." And it's interesting to talk about harm reduction and demoralizing and kind of the way physicians are taught versus policymakers. I want to transition the cognitive dissonance argument at the higher level, at the highest policy level. You mentioned Dr. Rahul Gupta and his advocacy for harm reduction. That stands in contrast with what we see among certain lawmakers and what we see among certain institutions. To the DEA's credit, they are now more receptive to public input. They are at least willing to consider some harm reduction concepts, but there's still a little bit of a divide. How does that play out in terms of policy, legislation, and how the two sides communicate?
First of all, as a physician, I find it offensive that I need to persuade a law enforcement agency to give me permission to use my best judgment to treat my patients. They're not doctors. And they have their own biases. And to be fair, we have our biases. But their biases is from a law enforcement and a moralizing perspective. You know, drugs are bad. We got to stop people from using drugs. They're not the right people to... We shouldn't have to be asking them this. Now, as we all know, the DEA is actually charged with coming up with quotas every year that they tell all of the manufacturers of various opioid narcotics and controlled substances. This is how much injectable morphine can be made in 2024. This is how much oral oxycodone can be made in 2024. This is how much... Adderall can be manufactured in 2024. Any of the controlled substances, and they actually designate different manufacturers of different these substances how much of that they can make. So, lots of times, if a plant has to temporarily close for quality control measures, we get a shortage because the other plants, unless they get permission, they can't pick up production beyond their quota to make up for the fact that one of these plants shut down. Well, just from the standpoint of, look at what you're asking them to do. How could they possibly know how much of each of these categories of drugs that help people are going to be needed next year? When you have such a diverse and growing population, over 330 million people, all different people, different clinical situations, you're actually asking them to do something that nobody, it's impossible to do. And of course, Hayek always made us, Friedrich Hayek, the great Nobel winning economist, talked about the knowledge problem. Central planners can never really know how much of anything we need because they're not omniscient. It's the market, supply and demand, that helps us figure out, and the price that helps us figure out what we need. So we have this situation where the DEA not only is trying to guess, give it a best guess, but they're actually going beyond that. They're ratcheting down each year.
Yeah.
So they're deciding that we need less. We're going to need less next year than this year. Why? Because I don't like you using that stuff. That's what they're doing. They're like being a parent, you know, and I find it offensive. And it's what's creating all sorts of shortages, including in hospitals. I'm sure you're aware, Jay, that sometimes hospitals will have all of a sudden a shortage of morphine or injectable fentanyl, and they have to cancel elective surgeries because many listeners may know, for example, intravenous fentanyl is very important as an anesthetic adjunct and given to people who are having surgery or procedures done. And if we don't have enough of it on hand, we have to postpone these necessary procedures, all because policemen, basically, they decided that you don't need that much fentanyl next year. And who's anybody? Even a pharmacologist couldn't decide that, let alone a policeman.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about that today, because today is the last day to comment on the DEA's proposed quota for 2024. So today being December 4th, in their acknowledgement, they state they consulted with the FDA, the CDC, and other organizations. How much of a correspondence actually takes place, who really knows? But in your estimate, what level of internal deliberance actually takes place? Where are they creating their assumptions? Or is it truly that parental, I'm cutting you down because I said so?
I think it's a combination of that and a combination of assumptions. And like I said, even if the FDA's background is not in law enforcement, or the CDC's background is not in law enforcement, as we learned with the CDC guidelines of 2016 that then became revised and flawed in 2022, they're making their recommendations based on assumptions, many of which are not true. I mean, if you don't mind, I'd like to segue to what the FDA has recommended now when it comes to nicotine.
Yeah, go ahead.
And menthol cigarettes. Okay, there's another thing. As long as we're in a harm reduction space, many people may think that nicotine, in fact, if you do surveys of the general public, they think nicotine is very dangerous. The only thing about nicotine is that it's a substance that is addictive. But the dangerous part of smoking is not the nicotine, it's the other components of tobacco smoke, combustible tobacco smoke. Nicotine, most people, when they're smoking to get the nicotine, because that is it's not much unlike caffeine. It's a stimulant, but it also helps you focus, and it also has a calming effect. It's an interesting drug, and so if you talk to most people who are smoking, they'll tell you they don't even like the taste of tobacco. They smoke for the feeling they get. So yet the FDA is ordering reductions in the nicotine content of tobacco cigarettes. There's a good reason to believe that that's going to actually have the unintended consequence of making people consume more cigarettes, because they're smoking to get the nicotine effect. And then you have this irrational opposition to nicotine e-cigarettes, while you're not opposed to nicotine patches or nicotine gum. Why is that? I mean, it's okay to have nicotine gum as a substitute for smoking. Because, in fact, the fact that we have and encourage people to use nicotine patches or nicotine gum is because we realize that if we can if we can get you to stop getting your nicotine through dangerous tobacco smoke and instead get it through some chewing gum or a skin patch, then we're satisfying your desire for nicotine, and you're not inhaling these carcinogens into your lungs. But somehow, if you get it in the form of a vape, well, that looks too much like smoking. So again, it's not rational, it's a bias. Yeah. It looks like smoking, even though, as I'm sure you're aware as a physician, the comparative effectiveness research shows that nicotine e-cigarettes are much more effective as nicotine replacement therapy to get people off tobacco smoking than are the gum, than is the gum or the skin patches. Yeah. So there's this irrational opposition to nicotine. Now we got a war on nicotine. And you tell me, you're the medical doctor, long-term nicotine is, I mean, it's not much more dangerous than having caffeine continuously. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, particularly with all factors considered equal. Yeah. What's most interesting about this argument is that vaping or e-cigarettes was actually considered a form of harm reduction when it first came out. And very quickly, it then became a substance of abuse, or at least a perceived substance of abuse. And it's very interesting how the context by which something was perceived then dictates how it can be used and in what context. And I think you highlighted very clearly that the absolute risk of nicotine relative to other forms of addictive substances like caffeine that's available is relatively equal. All factors considered, clinical factors considered equal. But when you start to look at the context of the use, the stigmatization almost in many ways creates the allure of abuse.
In fact, in the UK, the NH, National Health Service, they actually encourage doctors to give brochures to their smoking patients, asking them to consider switching to nicotine e-cigarettes. And they sometimes hand them out to people or give them coupons to get it, because they're much more rational on this one subject in the UK than we are here and in many parts of the European continent.
Speaking of rationality and the lack thereof, rather, let's transition to Colorado. So you recently wrote an article about a legislation that passed there that was SB 144. What is it, and what does it do for the patient-physician relationship in that state? And I think it's important to talk about the comparison of harm reduction and availability of certain clinical decision-making in the context of nicotine, and now transitioning that to the clinical encounter of prescription opioids.
Yeah, right. So back in when the CDC came out with its guidelines for treating chronic pain patients, which were very flawed and not evidence-based, 38 states ended up passing laws that adopted the guidelines in statute form to one extent or another, not necessarily 100%, but a lot of it. And they put physicians under sort of caps, saying you can't prescribe more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents of an opioid in a 24-hour period, unless you get, let's say, an opinion from a board-certified pain management specialist to say it's okay, depending on the state. But they use it as cutoffs, and they put limits on how many opioids pills may be given out, a number for a certain set period of time. And law enforcement, of course, had new targets now, so they would crack down on doctors because they'd be keeping track of this through prescription drug monitoring bases. And if they decided you're prescribing too many, then you might get a visit from law enforcement and show up on the nightly news in your community. And even if you did nothing wrong, your whole future, your career and your practice is destroyed. And so that intimidated many doctors to say, I'm just not going to prescribe opioids because I don't want to take that chance. So finally, in 2022, after many years of receiving criticism from professionals and pharmacologists, the CDC revised its guidelines, which were slightly better in that they said, just for your listeners, these morphine milligram equivalent conversion tables is true junk science. In fact, Dr. Navarendas Gupta at University of North Carolina pointed out in a paper that most of them were derived from subjective pain score studies done on cancer patients back in the 1980s. And for those who don't know what I'm talking about, it's like you give patient A, let's say 5 milligrams of oxycodone, patient B, 5 milligrams of hydrocodone. And then you say on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your pain now? And if one person with the oxycodone says, my pain is down to a 5, and the other one says, my pain is down to a 2, they say, okay, so oxycodone is almost twice as potent as hydrocodone. That's, believe it or not, that was the science. Nothing that went into toxicology of toxicologic effects, like whether it makes you stop breathing or anything like that. And that somehow, this is science. Is a lot of medicine is based on, they just accept what somebody else said, and then another person copies that person. Before you know it, it becomes something we just do and accept, assume. And one day somebody says, why are we doing this? Did anybody ever check to see if this really works? I can't think how many times we see this in medicine, right? So, and pharmacologists from the get-go are saying, you can't have equivalence in morphine. You can't have a conversion between morphine and, let's say, oxycodone. Yeah. So many factors. You know, what's the person's kidney function? How are they metabolizing? All sorts of things. So what are the drugs they have? Anyway, they took
Dr. Singer, let me, I apologize. I think just for context, I'd like to just quote exactly the original study and the reference of the morphine milligram equivalent. I think you might find that interesting. So this was in a 1974 JAMA article in which they first mentioned about the morphine milligram equivalents, and then it was rebutted. And this is the actual terminology that was presented in JAMA. Counter to that of standard texts and journals of pharmacology, and is not consistent with their own experience. While it's accepted that they talk about meperidine at the time, dose equivalent to 10 milligrams of morphine is 75 to 100 milligrams, duration of analgesia by meperidine may be as little as 50% that of morphine in chronic and sustained pain. So basically what they are saying is that physicians are under-treating patients in pain if we're using these types of false equivalencies to look at overall opioid strengths and risk.
Right. So after coming under a bunch of flack, the 2022 guidelines, they removed that section that said don't exceed more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents. But they kind of cheated because they also say when your prescription dose approaches 50 morphine milligram equivalents, which is almost half that, that's when you should start proceeding with caution. Those are their words, right? So they got rid of the MME conversion table at the same time that they didn't get rid of it. But in any case, it doesn't really matter because in my state of Arizona, it doesn't matter what the CDC said in 2022. We doctors are still stuck in the year 2016 because until the legislature decides to do something about the 2016 guidelines that they put into statute, we're operating under those, which is another reason why lawmakers should not put into statute medical science, which if any, you would think 3 years after the COVID pandemic hit, we would realize that most of what we know about medical science is a work in progress. We're learning as we're going. We could think we have all the answers now. 2 weeks from now, we realize, no, that wasn't it. If you put that into law, you just fixed it in concrete. Well, in Colorado, they did do something to fix that. They passed a law saying that basically doctors cannot be penalized for using their best judgment to treat their chronic pain patients with whatever dose they think is appropriate to control their patient's pain, and that these morphine milligram equivalent conversion tables shall not apply in the state of Colorado, and doctors should feel comfortable being able to prescribe it. The only thing I have a problem philosophically with is it also said that pharmacists cannot refuse to fill a prescription because they decided that they're not going to fill a prescription where a person's getting more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents. I don't think we should dictate the judgment in either direction. I think we should be consistent and just say people should be able to use their judgment. Even when I kind of agree with the sentiment, I don't think that's the right thing to do. But Colorado did that. That's great because they finally decided to allow doctors to use their best judgment with their patients and repudiated the morphine milligram equivalents.
Now, let's play that a little bit further and talk actual clinical scenarios. Are physicians still at risk from DEA-based investigations? And what I mean by that is, though the law has changed, does that affect at all how the interpretations of the law may lead to selective enforcement?
Yeah, because that's just the state of Colorado, first of all, and that's state level, but not federal level. So the DEA considers itself pretty much immune to state laws. For example, New Hampshire and several other states have a law on the books that says that if you want to go through the Prescription Drug Monitoring Board's database to go like on a fishing expedition to see if you could see some doctor who's a quote unquote outlier, you need a search warrant. You need a warrant from a judge saying that there's probable cause. The DEA asked New Hampshire to see their database. New Hampshire said, just give us a warrant. And they said, no, you didn't hear us. We said, we want to see your database. And yeah, give us a warrant. That's the law here. He said, yeah, but we're the feds. We don't have to listen to state law. And it went to court and they prevailed. A similar case happened in Oregon. So the DEA is basically, they're not subject to these things. And so they could always, raid a doctor's office. And not just in treating pain, but also in treating addiction. Yeah. There's a story, an article that I co-authored with two professors of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Vanderbilt Medical School in Tennessee. It's going to be scheduled to come out on December 19th in Kevin MD. There was a very highly respected doctor in the state of Tennessee, Dr. Tom Reach, who is an addiction specialist, and he was treating patients with buprenorphine. He had, at the time, he got the X waiver from the Drug Enforcement Administration to be able to prescribe buprenorphine, which is that and methadone are the two proven effective forms of medication-assisted treatment for addiction. And he'd been doing it for years. In fact, he was highly regarded enough that he would come and give guest lectures at the Vanderbilt University Medical School. Everybody had a great amount of respect for him. And the DEA raided his office.
Wow.
And as happens, I don't have to tell you, what ends up happening is they get the doctor to either they don't charge you or they find something like they get you to agree to a plea bargain to something that you didn't do, but it's much less of a penalty than if you lost in court for the thing they're accusing you of doing, so you take it. And that's what happened in his case. He agreed to a plea bargain to pleading guilty. I think it had something to do with labeling the drugs they keep in the medicine cabinet in the clinic. Some, minor little infraction. So obviously they didn't have anything if they were willing to do that. And that was like six months in prison, something like that. But according to Tennessee law, he lost his license to practice medicine because of that, because the licensing law didn't allow that. So Tennessee just lost. And the patients with addiction in the rural parts of eastern Tennessee just lost a very distinguished, experienced, highly respected addiction specialist. So now, at the end of 2022, Congress passed a law that took away the requirement for doctors to get an X waiver. It's actually X, your DEA narcotics license, in order to prescribe buprenorphine, because Congress realized that buprenorphine works. Want to make it as available as possible. So, and doctors were not prescribing it because they want to go through all those regulatory hoops to get the X waiver and the hours of training and all that other stuff. So they passed a law saying no more X waiver. Starting now, if you want to prescribe buprenorphine to treat addiction, you go right ahead, as long as you have a DEA narcotics license. And a lot of people who are following this are lamenting, gee, even though we passed that law, we don't seem to be seeing a lot of uptake among addiction specialists wanting to, or primary care doctors wanting to treat addiction with buprenorphine. They don't have to get an X waiver. Why aren't they jumping at the opportunity? Why? Because as soon as you do that, you got a target on your back, that the DEA is going to surveil you and try to catch you for something. So many doctors are just making a benefit risk decision, saying, know what, as much as I'd like to help people with addiction, I just can't afford to take a chance. So a lot of the problem is law enforcement. Because even when states relax their laws, like they did in Colorado, or like the federal government did with respect to the X waiver, you're not going to see doctors adjust what they're doing yet because they're afraid. They're still afraid of what the law enforcement's going to do.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the DEA and this concept of administrative credibility. And what I mean by that is you gave the example of the DEA prevailing in court in New Hampshire against the state, I assume, professional licensing agency requesting a search warrant. We talked about the case of Dr. Reach in Tennessee. In all of these instances, there seems to be a benefit of the doubt or a certain level of credibility toward the DEA in that the powers that be say, well, the DEA must know what they're doing. They have the final say-so. And I've seen that. The DOJ is deferential, the CDC, FDA, legislators. There's a certain reverence to the DEA, despite many people not necessarily agreeing with their approach. Where does that come from?
I think a lot of it, again, has to do with biases and moralizing. I co-authored a white paper for the Cato Institute, came out in 2022. Called Cops Practicing Medicine, the parallel histories of what we call Drug War One and Drug War Two. Drug War One was from 1914 with the Harris Narcotics Act until around the 1960s, and Drug War Two is from the President Nixon's war on drugs, and it's still going. My co-author, Trevor Burrus, is a constitutional scholar, a lawyer and constitutional scholar. So he focused more on the case law. I focused more on the medical science in the paper. And he showed how every time cases would come to the courts, they tended to defer to the arguments made by law enforcement. And sometimes we jokingly, it's like sarcastically or cynically referred to it as the drug war exception to the rule of law. A perfect example, the very famous Raich case about medical marijuana in California. This woman named Raich, in keeping with California law, was growing marijuana on her own property and giving it, not even selling it, to her neighbors for medicinal uses. And the DEA arrested her. And she said, I'm following, completely complying with California law. There's nothing I'm doing here is illegal. Now, this is the same Supreme Court. This is when Antonin Scalia was there, that had just made huge moves in favor of reining in the misuse of the Commerce Clause. Because a lot of times when politicians would pass laws in Congress, that you would say, does the federal government have any jurisdiction here? Isn't this a state issue? They would give the excuse, well, we have the right to regulate interstate commerce, and this is commerce. And they were calling all sorts of things commerce. So I don't want to get too off topic, but there were a series of cases where that court said, no, a lot of things that you're just, a lot of federal laws that you're justifying based on the interstate commerce clause is actually not interstate commerce, and we're finding them unconstitutional. Like the Federal Gun Free School Zones Act, the Federal Violence Against Women's Act. Those are examples, okay? So meanwhile, you would think, well, then if they're thinking that way, then surely they'll see that this is not interstate commerce. This is grown on your land to be shared, not even sold, but to be handed to people on nearby land within the same state. Surely they'll say the federal government is out of line here. No, they didn't. They said, in this particular case, the federal government was justified. Why? Because it was marijuana. Mm-hmm. Marijuana bad.
Yeah.
See?
So that's interesting. For the listening audience, just to clarify, the Commerce Clause refers to, and this is from the Legal Information Institute, Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which, quote, gives Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, among states, and with Indian tribes, but it's commonly used to justify exercising legislative power over the activity of states and their citizens. And so what Dr. Singer is alluding to is how that clause often leads to overreach being justified in the courts.
Right, right. So there's this bias where it seems like they could be very consistent, except when it comes to some evil drug. You know, and by the way, what makes them evil? I mean, among the most dangerous drugs that we have is alcohol, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Alcohol causes all sorts of problems, including in some people violence. But that's legal, and it should be, by the way. Meanwhile, many of these illicit drugs, what makes them dangerous, a large part of what makes them dangerous is the fact that they're illegal, so people get them on the black market, where you don't know if the dose is right or what even it is, what it says it is, or what it's adulterated with. But a lot of those drugs, in long-term use of many of those drugs, are actually a whole lot less harmful than the long-term use of a legal drug like alcohol.
I want to talk about that last point you made, because at various seminars by the Cato Institute, that issue comes up about the power of the black market and the importance of destigmatizing and regulating the use in a safe environment, particularly a free and fair market. Many administrators, particularly with a law enforcement background, will say that if we do legalize certain drugs, the black market will simply undercut what is the free and fair legal market. Do you ascribe to that belief, or do you see that's maybe an oversimplification?
I don't see the only way the black market undercuts it is if, when the drug is legalized, there are a lot of string regulatory and tax strings attached. So, for example, in California and in New York State, they legalized marijuana, right? But they had so many requirements on and such strict quotas on who can operate a legal marijuana retail center. And they put huge taxes on the marijuana, excise taxes, such that it became so expensive that people living in California, New York, rationally said, oh, well, if it's legal and I can't get arrested for possessing or using it, I'll just get what I'll get the marijuana from the person I was getting it from all the time, because it's like a tenth the price if I went to this marijuana store. So if you're going to legalize it, but you're going to effectively create prohibition through prohibitive taxation and regulation, then the black market is going to come into effect. But if you legalize it, and you can still tax it, but tax it at, you know, at a reasonable rate, and don't make it so onerous for people to open up dispensaries, then the black market will disappear. I mean, we're seeing the same thing when it comes to tobacco cigarettes. In New York, it's so expensive to buy a pack of cigarettes that there's a very healthy black market in people selling cigarettes on the street. And sometimes they sell what they call loosies, which are loose individual cigarettes. We all know the famous story of Eric Garner, who was arrested for selling loose cigarettes on a street in New York City. I think it was in Staten Island. And of course, he died from a chokehold that a police officer used on him. So now in this case, same thing. Tobacco is legal, but if you make it prohibitive, then you're going to create a black market.
Interesting. Yeah, very true. Let's transition now to something a little more optimistic, and that's the future. 2024 is going to be a very interesting year, because we have the presidential elections, we have a lot of state legislation that's underway, and presidential election years tend to be more turbulent than most. 2016, we saw a lot of prohibitionist policies that were coming in vogue, and now we're starting to see some harm reduction efforts coming to place, and in some places, harm reduction being reeled in, if you will. What does 2024 look like to you? Do you see progress, or do you see a lot of volatility with kind of a net draw in the end?
I see a lot of volatility. On the one hand, some of it actually has made, because it's an election year, it's made some politicians a little more cautious about proceeding with harm reduction. For example, this past summer, I think it was, lawmakers in California passed a law allowing for overdose prevention center pilot programs in the Los Angeles area and the Bay Area, which, you know, we know overdose prevention centers, you often in the past they were called safe consumption sites, but overdose, there's two operating in New York City, and in their first year they saved 1,000 lives to reversing overdose deaths. They're federally illegal. The city of New York actually approved those two in defiance of federal law. So far, nothing's happened. The state of Rhode Island legislature also approved it, providing that they're privately funded, and the first overdose prevention center is scheduled to open up there at the beginning of this year, coming year. And in Minnesota, they just also legalized it. So California, the most populous state, they passed a law allowing for pilot programs on overdose prevention centers. And they have a state that has a record of being pretty good on harm reduction. So Governor Newsom vetoed it. And that was a surprise, because it was not kind of keeping with his previous behavior. Many people would have expected he was going to sign it, but then he might have national aspirations, aspirations for a national office. And a lot of people think that the reason why he vetoed it is because, you know, that may play well in the coastal areas, that idea, but in middle America, a lot of critics say, wait a minute, you're going to invite people inside to use drugs? I can't believe it. So he decided to, I subscribe to that opinion. I mean, nobody knows what was in his head, but I subscribe to the explanation that he decided to play it safe politically, because in case he wants to run for higher office. So one of the election years, sometimes they tend to make politicians a little more reticent to do what is perceived as a bold kind of measure. They tend to rein things in and get very cautious and conservative rather than be accused by their opponents of being radical. So that's the downside of it. Another thing that concerns me, as I'm watching all of the Republican candidates for president, including Donald Trump, they're all coming out for this idea of invading Mexico or sending special forces in after the cartels, which, you know, it didn't work when we had Plan Colombia in the Clinton administration to try to get rid of the cocaine trade. Cocaine prices have never been cheaper, and cocaine-related overdose deaths have never been higher. So it didn't work, but it sure created a miserable life for the people living in Colombia. So, and there it was easier because you could, burn down fields where coca was being grown. But fentanyl is made in labs, in basements, How are you going to do that without, having urban warfare? So with a whole lot of innocent people getting injured and destabilizing our largest trading partner that we share a 2,000-mile border with and have friendly relationships with, why in the world do you want – and you think that's going to do anything except maybe move the fentanyl trade to another country? That's all it's going to do after you destroy your neighbor. And so what worries me is I'm hearing a lot of this jingoistic talk. Now, it may be just talk and, chest beating and bellicose talk in hopes of, winning the primary and getting elected. But that's a worrisome trend.
Yeah. I want to end with possibly an unfair, but I think important question that the audience would be very interested in. Every election cycle, there's always one healthcare issue that rises to the fold. Most of the time it's abortion, but let's maybe take that issue to the side and focus on the context of prohibitionist policies, whether that's prescription opioids, harm reduction. What is the one issue, if you can contextualize it in kind of just a byline, what is the one issue that you think is going to be hotly contested this election cycle?
Well, I think there are going to be a few key ones. Obviously, as wasn't it, James Carville famously said, it's the economy, stupid. So probably the overwhelming issue is going to be inflation and economic issues. But another major issue we're hearing a lot is immigration and the border. What has particularly frustrated me is that there's this tendency for people who want restrictions on immigration to conflate the fentanyl trade coming across the border into the United States with immigration. You hear this all the time, that we got to control that border. They're bringing in fentanyl. It's not like immigrants are bringing in fentanyl. In fact, the data show that more than 93% of fentanyl seizures are at legal border crossings from U.S. citizens. In fact, my colleague David Beer at the Cato Institute did this study on that. It was entitled U.S. Citizens Smuggle Fentanyl Through Legal Border Crossings to Sell to U.S. Citizens. And only 0.009% of all people caught by Border Patrol between legal border crossings are ever found to have fentanyl on them. And when you think about it, if you're in the it's a business. So you're the one of the cartels in Mexico, and you want to get fentanyl into the United States, and you're making billions and billions of dollars doing this. So what makes more sense to you to pay, let's say, $100,000 cash to a quote unquote mule who's a U.S. citizen who may have an impeccable record, and you make sure the person dresses very conservatively and looks real good, and they have it. Fentanyl, very few dogs are able to smell fentanyl, so it's not detectable, and it's so powerful you could smuggle tiny, tiny packages in different places, and you just, you know, very calmly cross through the U.S. border crossing at, let's say, El Paso or Tijuana. You show your passport, you answer the questions, and you're told, have a nice day, welcome back to the United States. And then when you get to the other side, you give it to the person you're supposed to give it to. What makes more sense for you as a cartel head? To pay $100,000 to that person to do that, which is pocket money for you, or hope that some peasant and his family who's struggling to make it across the frontier in 110 degree heat between the state of New Mexico and the Mexican state of Sonora, put some of this in your backpack. And then if you make it alive across the border, I want you to meet up with this person to give it to him. Come on, what makes more sense? You know, so what one of the, I think the immigration issue is going to be a big one. And what bothers me is that I think it's intentional because everybody's upset with the overdose death rate.
Yeah.
And I was at a conference about this in Houston, Texas a few weeks ago. And I was asked, how is the fentanyl overdose crisis an immigration issue? And I said, it only is tangentially related to immigration in that it crosses the border, but it's a prohibition crisis. It's the fact that it is so lucrative, that prohibition makes it so lucrative to smuggle fentanyl across the border. And also that prohibition incentivizes the production of more potent forms of drugs. So that's why we migrated from diverted prescription pain pills to heroin, and then from heroin to fentanyl, and now from fentanyl to fentanyl and xylazine. So it's a prohibition problem, but most politicians, and I think they may even know this, I think they're dishonestly trying to conflate the two, because that makes people even more upset about our border. And so I think that's probably one of the other major, I know it's going to be one of the other major issues in this election.
Yeah, it's a shame, you know, as the saying goes, an angry voter is more likely to turn out. Well,
yeah.
With that, Dr. Singer, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.